Welcome to the Ready to Run podcast. I'm your co-host, Efren Kabalius, and I'm a sports medicine physician.
I'm your co-host, Kurt Roser, and I'm a physical therapist. We're based out of the Boulder, Colorado area and have a passion for working with endurance athletes of all abilities. The goal of our podcast is to engage in thoughtful discussions with athletes, coaches, and clinicians to share knowledge within the field of sports medicine and inspire progression in the sport of running.
We hope to empower individuals to navigate injuries, reduce injury risk, optimize training and performance, and provide listeners with the tools needed to get ready to run.
You'll be able to listen to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you enjoy listening to podcasts. Subscribe and leave a rating and review to let us know what you think and what you'd like to hear on the show.
You can also follow us on Instagram at Ready to Run Podcast, as well as our website, readytorunpodcast.com. All right. Well, welcome back to the Ready to Run podcast. We're both back from a hiatus as I am recovering from COVID. Finally got to me after 3 years. And fortunately, didn't have it that bad and recovering well. So here we are, and we're going to talk about a topic that we've both seen fairly recently in increasing amounts in our clinics, and that is something called Hagelin syndrome. So first, we'll start by just defining what that is. So basically what you have here is there's something called a Hagelin's deformity. And what that is basically a bony enlargement of the posterior superior aspect of the calcaneus, or the back of the heel. And this is otherwise known as a pump bump. And it has significant anatomy because this is where the Achilles tendon inserts. And then between the tendon and the bone is a fibrocartilaginous structure known as the retrocalcaneal bursa. So pain in the heel can arise from any of these structures alone or in combination. And overall, this injury tends to affect about 10% of runners, and statistically, approximately like 25% of patients with insertional Achilles tendinopathy may have an associated Hagelin's deformity. Hagelin's deformity can also be asymptomatic. And when someone has the triad of Hagelin's deformity plus insertional Achilles tendinopathy plus retrocalcaneal bursitis, this is known as Hagelin syndrome. So it's a lot of confusing terminology that we just threw out at you. And we really want to take the time to dissect this, how it presents, how we diagnose it, and then how we treat it both non-surgically and surgically.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for those definitions. In the, I guess, PT, you know, practice, typically, like, you're going to see somebody either direct access or with a script for maybe the most specific thing, unless someone's been dealing with it for a while and had further diagnosis, is going to be insertional Achilles tendinopathy or just something to differentiate between mid portion Achilles tendinopathy. But yeah, I think in the PT world, we're going to start off more broadly, just calling it, you know, insertional Achilles tendinopathy. And then I think for most intents in the PT realm, your treatment strategy is going to be the same initially. But what I've really learned in the past couple of years is in the folks that aren't kind of getting better, if they haven't had imaging to kind of figure out more specifically like what's going on and try to diagnose exactly maybe what structures are at play and preventing this from responding to treatment, I think it's a really important thing to kind of get these folks into a sports medicine physician and kind of get some diagnostic imaging to figure out exactly where you could put your efforts into as far as like treatment strategies.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but this is something I've seen more frequently. And I don't know if that's a function of just seeing more runners in general as my practice has evolved, or if it's something that's just happening more frequently. And who knows what issues may be at play, just increase in general of runners or the effect of super shoes or things like that. I'm unsure, but I don't know. What are you seeing?
Yeah, I'd say for me, it's kind of like about the same, you know, in terms of like prevalence. But this is definitely the one of, if not the most difficult injuries to rehab in a runner, just because it's one of those things that, you know, similar to like the low back research, like, you know, a good percentage are going to get better in a predictable time frame, but then that percentage that doesn't get better, you know, that 5 or 10 or 20% or whatnot, that's going to be a pretty long-term injury that's pretty limiting and hard to get them back to their functional capacity. But I wonder if, you know, now people are just getting more treatment for it, because I think in the past people would get it and try to maybe rehab it themselves. Maybe they go to PT, you know, maybe they'd see a sports medicine physician, but I just think there's more treatment options and more known about it. And the surgeries for people that are getting surgeries are, I think, more successful in the past 10 years or so. So I think maybe people are just like coming in to address it more instead of just like, you know, not doing anything about it or trying to manage it or just, you know, stopping running. So maybe that's a factor of getting more people in that you're seeing.
Yeah. And I think it's just one of those injuries where like really, truly having an understanding of the anatomy of the surrounding structures that live in the back of the heel at the Achilles tendon insertion really helps your ability to treat these patients effectively so that you can channel them in the right direction early in their course rather than later.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely helps. And one of the big, I guess, I don't know if changes, but like in the past, like 5 years or so, what was new to me in managing this is, you know, basically avoiding having people going into dorsiflexion, temporarily at least. So a lot of times people, you know, they're going to, their first instinct is to, well, this feels tight, let me stretch it. So then they start stretching it, you know, three times a day with just a whatever calf stretch. And then maybe they're actually irritating the tendon farther by compressing the tendon up against the back of, maybe it's the bursa that's inflamed, or maybe it's like that actual Haglund's deformity. And so tendons don't like to be compressed from that angle. So then the tendon's actually getting more and more irritated, and you're kind of just keeping yourself in that really highly irritable cycle. So that's a big kind of a big change in the PT realm is, you know, probably don't stretch initially, and avoiding other activities that take you into end range dorsiflexion, because that we think is probably a factor that's like kind of keeping this like highly sensitized and pretty irritable and inflamed for people.
Yeah, the compression nature of this injury is really one of the key hallmarks in terms of knowing what irritates it and how to diagnose it and then how to effectively treat it. But let's talk a little bit about how these patients will present. So this is typically a patient complaining of a pretty well-localized pain at the back of the heel and typically located at the insertion point of the Achilles. So this is different than our other more common type of Achilles tendinopathy, which we've talked about on past episodes, which is like closer to like 6 to 8 centimeters higher up from the insertion. So these are really pinpoint at the insertion. And they'll present with swelling. Sometimes you'll actually see a visible bump on the back of the heel, and the patient may complain of like not being able to wear certain shoes because it rubs up against their heel and irritates that area. In the course of their run, they may notice limping, and it's also something that can occur on one side or both sides.
Have you noticed, is it more common to have pain at the lateral aspect of the calcaneus or the medial aspect? I feel like a lot of the runners I work with might have an asymptomatic kind of like bump more on the lateral aspect of the calcaneus, but I was curious if you knew anything of if it like actually was more common to have pain on the either side.
Yeah, you can definitely have pain on either side. I'm not sure what statistically what that looks like, but I know usually when I'm examining, I'll you know palpate directly at the insertion and then medial or laterally, and then what I'll do is like, you know, as they complain of pain on either the medial or lateral side, then just passively dorsiflex their ankle, or maybe have them do it under weight bearing conditions. And that's the thing that's challenging about this, because whether or not they have the deformity, it's hard to say whether it's the that's what's causing the pain, or if it's the compression of the bursa that's causing the pain. But either way, just it can present either way, and you know, it just helps kind of clue you in to like looking at the whole mm-hmm. surrounding tissue for sure. And I even had one case that's actually pretty interesting, patient with Haglund's deformity and retrocalcaneal bursitis that was pretty inflamed, and to the point this person couldn't run and they were even limping. And there was so much buildup of fluid in that bursa that some of that had actually tracked medially and then was compressing on the posterior tibial nerve on the inside of the ankle and creating a tarsal tunnel-like syndrome with patients complaining of numbness and tingling. And so, and what we did in the office was under ultrasound guidance, we actually went in and just aspirated the bursa. You didn't inject anything, just suck the fluid out to decompress the area. And then the pain with running dorsiflexion and even the numbness and tingling had resolved within about a week or so.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they can present a variety of ways for sure.
Yeah. And I've seen that too, where there seems to be a flux of the amount of visible swelling that you can actually see in people just from like a week to week snapshot. And we should say that it is, normal. There's a, I don't know the percentage, but like you said earlier, high rate of runners that have an asymptomatic Haglund's deformity. So it'd be interesting to know what that number is if we, took a snapshot of a certain type of runner. And we don't want people out there listening to think like, oh, I've got this, so it's inevitable that I'm going to get insertional Achilles pain. And just small sample size, but I think pretty much all of the fastest runners that I work with in terms of track athletes and stuff have an asymptomatic, knock on wood, Haglund's deformity. So, it's probably one of those things there where if you're developing this, it's because you're loading your tendons and using your tendons very effectively to store and release energy. So not necessarily a bad thing unless it's painful and causing you problems and limitations.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I have several athletes who have smaller deformities who are still running at the highest level with minimal or no symptoms at all. So I guess it's hard to say, degree of size of deformity plays a role. Certainly the location, because it's that area when it's, I think when they have the deformity closest to the Achilles tendon insertion, those tend to be more problematic. Whereas you can have a prominence a little bit more anterior to the insertion itself, where you just have a bump on the Achilles. And anecdotally, I think these seem to be less problematic than the ones that really truly compress the tendon.
That makes sense. So if it's farther distal, it's going to be more likely to be compressing the tendon.
Exactly.
Just less space. And so the Haglund's actual bony deformity, that's not really changing or worsening over time, really, is it? Or can that actually get bigger over time? Or has anybody looked at that?
Yeah, I'm not sure that's been looked at. That's the problem with this, is there's a lot that we don't know. I guess in... Yeah, I don't know what the literature says on that, honestly.
Because I think visibly, if we're looking at it, or if I'm looking at it, and the patient maybe is looking at it and is feeling like it's getting bigger over time, that's probably not a bony change, maybe, is what I'm thinking. Maybe it's the bursa, or there's, just who knows what amount of thickening around the tendon or whatever is causing that to visibly look a bit bigger. But
yeah, I mean, I guess suppose it could be more of a cumulative overload over time, where you have enough irritation and degeneration of the fiber cartilage in the bursa. Or we'll talk about this in terms of the diagnostics, when if it starts to create irritability and tearing in the Achilles tendon insertion from delamination, certainly that could be a problem. Or maybe sometimes the bony deformity itself may stay the same, but because of the constant irritation, eventually you can get these calcific changes in the superficial fibers of the tendon, which may become more painful over time.
Mm-hmm. So let's say we've got our diagnosis, we feel confident in that, and maybe this is a person that's maybe not running at all, let's say, because of pain. But where do we start? So where do we go from diagnosis to our rehab journey?
Yeah. So I think imaging these is really, really crucial, so we know what we're dealing with. So what I'll typically start with is an X-ray, particularly the lateral view of the ankle is probably the most informative to me, because then you can see the actual deformity itself and the size of it, and also look at other things that may be causing posterior heel pain, ruling out things like calcaneal stress injuries, which may also mimic posterior heel pain, or other things that can cause posterior ankle pain, such as like an os trigonum, which is like a bony deformity on the back of the talus, which can also present with posterior heel pain. However, the difference with those is that they don't really have pain with dorsiflexion per se, but more so with plantar flexion. So standing on your tiptoes. But I like to get the X-ray for that reason. And then also, again, I have access to ultrasound in my clinic, and you can actually gain a lot of valuable information from that, because you can assess the tendon itself. You can assess the retrocalcaneal bursa to see if there's any signs of inflammation there. You can also assess to see if there's bone spurs that are unrelated to a Haglund's deformity. So a little bit more distal at the tip of the Achilles insertion. Oftentimes you can see bone spurs there. And what I'll do is I'll palpate around and kind of note, is the pain near the bursa? Is the pain at the tendon insertion, or is the pain closer down to the bone spur? And that'll help dictate what the appropriate treatment is. The other thing you can see in some cases, you can actually see a communication of the retrocalcaneal bursa fluid going into the Achilles tendon if there is like a delaminating tear on the anterior fibers of the tendon. And then more chronic cases, as I mentioned, you can also see calcifications within the tendon as well from the chronic repetitive compression. And in cases that are somewhat equivocal, one thing you can do is diagnostically inject lidocaine into a focal tear. And what you'll see is if there is like a pretty significant longitudinal tear, that tear might open up as you inject the lidocaine. And you know, that might dictate, whether or not you need to also address the tendon as well as the bony deformity. We wanted to take a quick break to share our experience with Joint Health Plus from Prevenix. Joint pain is one of the most common injuries seen in runners of all ages and becomes increasingly prevalent as we get older. Luckily, we know that running is not bad for your knees and joints and does not increase your risk of osteoarthritis. In fact, being physically active and exercising regularly is very important for joint health and overall health.
I've tried a number of products over the years targeted at joint health and haven't liked any as much as I like this new blend from Prevenix called Joint Health Plus. I've taken it for about 6 months now and had my best marathon training block with less knee and ankle stiffness after long runs and bigger workouts. I also seem to come off the marathon really well in terms of recovery. It uses a proprietary blend of anti-inflammatories that are clinically proven to decrease pain in people who exercise. I think it is definitely worth giving a try for a couple months if you're dealing with any joint pain or stiffness, in conjunction, of course, with strengthening, load management, and overall eating well and doing all of the other little things that we all should be doing. Check out Prevenix.com. That's Previnex, and use code Ready to Run for 15% off your first order. Prevenix offers a 100% satisfaction money back guarantee, and their mission is to spread health to all of us. Prognosis wise, like some of these things are probably going to be leading us towards to thinking like, oh, this is going to be a fairly probably successful, conservatively managed sort of situation, or are there some of those things like you mentioned might kind of lend you to think like, oh, this is maybe has a lower chance of being successful with conservative
management? I think the calcification, I think whenever I see that, that's a little bit more concerning to me, because that's very hard to manage non-surgically, because you end up getting that mechanical compression and irritability, and they're also very hard to treat with injection treatments, because there are things like tendon scraping, which I might use in certain cases for somebody with like a mid portion Achilles tendon injury, where I might be a little bit more hesitant to do that, and someone has a calcification of the tendon due to the possible risk of rupturing and creating more complications there. Mm-hmm. But prognostically wise, I think another helpful tool is like getting an MRI in these patients. Because what I'm looking for is like bony edema at the calcaneus. And so if I see an edematous calcaneus associated with some Achilles tendon injury and a fairly raging bursitis, then ultimately, you know that that Hägglunds is really contributing significantly to the pain. Because if it's not edematous, you know, then you know that it's not as irritable. But if it is swollen, that tends to be more problematic in terms of trying to treat these non-surgically. Because I've had some cases where, you know, you'll have an edematous calcaneus, Hägglunds deformity, there might be a insertional tear. And if you just try to treat the tear alone, you're only going to be half successful because you're really not addressing that. You're really just addressing the surrounding soft tissue, but not really the bony lesion. So eventually, with enough time and training, the symptoms are likely to then reappear.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these things, like, you know, with diagnostically, they're really just adding clues to the diagnosis. You know, I think most of what I learn is really truly from the physical exam, but this really helps me kind of pinpoint, well, is this someone who stands a good chance to treat this conservatively, or should we be thinking more towards intervention?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was great. Thanks for breaking all that down. And I think we should also say, like, we're talking about all the technical kind of clinical aspects of the diagnosis. But I think one thing that both you and I really value is that how we convey that information to the patient, you know, in terms of, like, you know, what we're putting the problem on, you know, in terms of structure, and just keeping in mind that, you know, once people are told something, they sometimes will never let go of that. And you can kind of really create some fear avoidance and catastrophizing. So I think this is an area where we got to be really careful in how we communicate these findings to people, and kind of ideally stick to the ones that we're confident have, you know, importance in terms of their outcomes from it. Because, you know, it's one of those things where you hear people come in and say, like, oh, so-and-so, you know, told me that I have a bone spur or whatever. That's an easy one to pick on. And that is never going to get better. And, you know, that might be right, but it also might be wrong. And I think we just don't know a lot of answers. So we got to be careful with how we talk to people about, this is one of those injuries in particular, I think. Cause it's also a scary one, and we know that it's going to take a long time to get better. Anyways, like, so, we don't want people to kind of lose faith in that process of, like, this might take 6 months or even a year to get better if it's going to get better. And I do still see that sometimes, even in, you know, our community that treats a lot of runners.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's also where the value of some of our imaging studies, and again, I'm biased towards ultrasound because I do a lot of it and I have access to it. With that, you can monitor things over time. So for some patients, I might bring them back at, like, you know, 6 or 8 week intervals as we're progressing through the rehab, if we're trying to treat this conservatively, and then really kind of look at the supporting structures. Like, if it's somebody with the isolated, like, maybe the bursa is causing the pain, and we can monitor, like, the degree of swelling in the bursa over time, and such that, you know, if a patient is improving and we're seeing reduction in swelling, then we know that we're, you know, we can continue along this pathway of non-surgical treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I was also wondering, like, I would imagine age has a effect as well in prognosis, where we would expect a younger individual would have faster healing rate and higher success rate of healing versus, you know, that kind of stereotypical master's runner guy who's been running, you know, 50 to 80 miles a week for 20 years or something. Is there much, as far as, like, research that we know past a certain point, the prognosis is not as good, or is it kind of just too variable to say?
I think it's too variable. I mean, most of the patients I'm seeing with this issue are going to be, like, college athletes or early patient runners in their early 20s, even up to, like, their 40s. Like, that's the group I'll typically see with this. I think partially why some of these don't persist longer is I think some of these just kind of self-select, where it hurts long enough and they either do something about it or decide, you know, hey, maybe you know, running's not the right activity for me, and do something that doesn't irritate the Achilles as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly in the college system, because, you know, 6 months is your whole 3 seasons potentially, you know.
Yeah, right.
If they get it in the fall, you know, you're gonna miss cross country, indoor and outdoor potentially. Hopefully not, but yeah, that would be hard. Yeah, in terms of the kind of the rehab for it, if we're going to switch gears, first off, like what do you think about people running when they're, you know, coming back from this injury, when you're first diagnosing with them, what are you telling people right at that time of diagnosis?
Yeah. I think just like any other tendinopathy, I mean, I think as long as they're able to tolerate some degree of activity with very minimal pain or functional limitations or, compensation of their gait, then that's totally appropriate. You know, we've talked about this before, where if you're able to keep your pain at below a 3 out of 10, or if it's like more like post-activity related pain, if it settles down within 24 hours of rest, that's totally appropriate to continue your activity. And also like looking at like the warm-up phenomenon, right? So tendons kind of classically, they might not feel so great. They might feel grumbly when you first get out the door. But after about 10 minutes, once you start moving, if that pain starts to subside, then yeah, sure, it's fairly reasonable. If you're finding that it's not quite warming up, or if it's in fact getting worse throughout the run, then that's usually where I'll kind of scale back the running and maybe do some sort of cross training in the meantime while we try to rehab these injuries and get this thing calm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that's one of the big differences between a mid portion Achilles tendinopathy and the insertional Achilles tendinopathy for me is being more conservative when I try to get people running again and how much I suggest they start with. Yeah. Just because it's seems to be so much more irritable, the insertional variety. So we want to just find a really stable place to start from and build on, and try to avoid the the kind of spikes and setbacks and things like that. But it can be really hard to titrate that. So I think one of my criterion is like if people can like pretty confidently go out and go for a walk for 30 to 60 minutes and they don't get any kickback from that, then I'm thinking, okay, well, let's try like a pretty small dose of running, like 10 minutes, even broken up into run walks. Mm-hmm. And just starting with that, and then use the pain monitoring model and the soreness rules to progress accordingly. The tricky thing I think also is that it's maybe part tendinopathy, but then it's also not a tendinopathy in that there's like the compression on the tendon and maybe pain from the bursa, and there's some other painful sources that we may or may not want to worry about how much those are hurting, but regardless they're going to hurt. And so it kind of confuses the situation versus if it's more proximal, it's easier to say like, oh, well, it's definitely the tendon that's hurting.
Yeah, they definitely have a harder time than the mid portion patients in terms of getting to that level of activity. And it's definitely important to have them like avoid any uphill kind of running, because that causes that repetitive ankle dorsiflexion and compression, which produces the pain. And also any speed work, they tend to be very sensitive to speed for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I guess, for example, like if I have somebody that I'm seeing for the first time and they haven't run for several weeks because of this injury, I'm probably going to want to work with them for at least 2 weeks, kind of just start getting them stronger in the key areas and more stable in key areas, and just be more confident that we're moving in the right direction before we jump into it. But if somebody's still running and they're able to maybe run easy, run on flats, then maybe we could talk about, avoiding hills, avoiding speed work, some shoe modifications, or shoe selection is maybe more appropriate. But, I see probably about once a month somebody who's Dremeled out the back of their shoes so that they can keep running. And I mean, the first time I saw that, I was like, well, that's not a great idea. I wouldn't tell you to do that, but I guess if it works, then just kind of let pain be your guide. And that actually tends to work out for some people, where the shoe, the back of the shoe, the heel cup kind of is like pressing on the heel, and that's really the most aggravating thing for them. Like that actually seems to be successful in people with pretty mild cases of this. So I'm not totally against the cutting out the heel of your shoe anymore, but you just got to be careful with things like that, because you're also, people are kind of like just searching for a means to keep running. And it's usually smarter to dial it back and not do kind of
If you're cutting your $250 paper flies, then there's probably an underlying cause that we need to address.
Exactly. Yeah. But then, yeah, from a PT standpoint, the big thing is like initially, if it's provoking symptoms, we want to avoid dorsiflexion, especially stretching. Stretching is not really going to make it better. Probably just going to aggravate things. So I'll have people do some, you know, self soft tissue mobilization with foam roller or whatever. In the clinic, we'll, you know, probably use some sort of manual therapy to improve ankle dorsiflexion, range of motion, and calf flexibility. And that tends to help as well. And that way we're not compressing the tendon by stretching it. Definitely, these are folks that, you know, you want to probably do some talcrural and midfoot joint mobilizations, just kind of make sure their ankle's moving and their midfoot's moving and they're kind of getting the first ray down to the ground. Kind of if somebody's on the extreme end of a stiff foot or a really floppy foot, kind of just addressing those aspects of the forefoot and ankle. And yeah, then up the chain to the pelvis and hips and kind of the whole lower extremity chain, just kind of like checking that out, seeing what you can optimize, especially if someone's not running. You know, we want to take that time to get stronger where they need to get stronger, get more stable where they need to get stable. And yeah, so for me, the foot and ankle stability and pelvic stability is a really key thing to address, I think, in these folks, because I think they often have some deficits there.
Yeah. One of the key distinctions in terms of how we load these tendons as compared to mid portion is when you do incorporate some sort of eccentric loading, you know, traditionally in mid portion Achilles tendinopathy, the Alfredson's heel drop protocol has you standing at the edge of a staircase, coming up onto your tiptoes, and then slowly lowering down over the course of 2 to 3 seconds past the edge of the staircase. That's totally appropriate for somebody with mid portion Achilles tendinopathy. However, as we mentioned before, that puts you in a position of ankle dorsiflexion, which can compress that tendon in the bursa. So there's actually a separate paper that came out, I think around 2008, which looked at some modifications to the Alfredson's protocol for insertional type of pain, where instead of doing that exercise off of a staircase, you do it on the level ground. So you're still getting that load applied to it, but without creating that excessive ankle dorsiflexion to irritate the tendon. And that seems to work quite well. And it's just an important thing to know, because I will still see on occasion a patient with this diagnosis and I'll send them to PT and then reevaluate them 6 weeks later and find out, oh, they've just been doing like the Alfredson's off of a staircase. And it's like, oh, shoot. Well,
shucks.
It's frustrating for patients because, like, we write a prescription and you guys want to make sure that we make that point of clarification right off the bat.
Yeah, only going to neutral. And these folks usually do pretty well with isometrics right out of the gate. So that's a good place to start. I like my 4x30-second isometric holds. And those are in neutral or slight plantar flexion, not like way up on their tiptoes, but slight plantar flexion, maybe like a centimeter, an inch off the ground if you're in weight bearing, or if they can be in neutral, like off of a step, that sometimes is good too. But yeah, isometrics are a good place to start. And then once those are tolerable, I just like to have people, easiest thing to do is just up and down to the floor and then just get comfortable with that for probably several weeks at least before you try dropping below. And some people maybe, you never have to, but if someone hasn't been running for a while anyways, you're going to need to kind of rehab that end range part of it going into some dorsiflexion if they're going to be getting back to fast running or speed running, or like depends on what type of running they're going to want to get back to. If their goal is to run 20 minutes easy 3 times a week, probably don't worry about it. But if they're trying to race a marathon at 5 minute pace, you're going to need to get that stronger. Otherwise it's going to be a problem eventually.
Yeah. So you'll add it in like later phases of your rehab. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Cause you can't like avoid hills. Mm-hmm. And if you're not prepared for that, then it's just going to blow up on race day.
Yeah. And as best you can, this is one of those things where try to add in like one new change a week, you know? So like if you're adding in, if you're changing a way that you're loading the calf and the Achilles, and you're adding in speed work or hills or, you know, some other variable, try to, as best you can, isolate the variables that are causing it to react as you're building back up, if you have any small setbacks. So that way you can kind of be like, well, let's not do that. Let's, you know, try this, or, you know, just be very intentional in what you're adding in, because people are definitely going to have flare-ups through this rehab journey, and deciding how to modify to keep them moving in the right direction long-term can be really tough. And you got to have some good patient buy-in that this is going to be a long-term process. And yeah, and you're going to need to find ways to progress what you can, because you can't always just throw more weight at them or things like that. Mm-hmm. So one of the other things I found really successful, and just in my small sample size of people that I've seen for this recently, it seems like people have a lot of deficits in just like global strength with this injury. So specifically the muscles that we really care about for running are quads, calves, glute max, glute med. So these are folks that, as soon as we can in the rehab process, I like to get them just doing some just bilateral, fairly heavy lifting for those muscle groups. So squats, deadlifts, hex bar, yeah, anything for the glute med. So I like to get people kind of excited about that. And hopefully that kind of helps with force transfer as they're getting back into running, is how I kind of sell it. But that's worked out well in folks recently, just kind of globally getting them stronger, working on your more traditional T stability type work. And then obviously the ankle specific thing.
Yeah.
The last thing is, like, you know, some plyometrics or running form drills, pogo hops, like, you know, give people things in pretty small chunks and in a small number of contacts, you know, so we're not blowing people up, but, usually, yeah, just training that energy storage and release is a pretty important part of this, because there's a lot of fear around this injury, and I think a lot of people have maybe had it in the past and just never rehab like that quick firing and stretch shortening cycle. So yeah, a little bit of plyos, but yeah, got to be gradual with easing those into the program.
Yeah, those are definitely some really good points. And I know sent a couple people to you who you've been able to manage quite successfully just by applying those principles.
Yeah, it takes time. That's the hardest thing with this one, is that it's most of the time going to be a fairly long rehab injury. And then I think the hard thing is, like, we can't give a, you know, pretty high guaranteed success rate, you know, like with a mid portion tendinopathy, you know, it's a very high success rate of, this is going to get better. It might take a while, but this is, I think in that paper that you cited, it was, instead of being like 80 or 90% for mid portion, insertional is more like a 50% success rate with that, which is, you know, better than nothing, but not great.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worthwhile to at least, as your first line treatment, to at least try your best to rehab these athletes and let them know that this isn't going to be an overnight fix. And also just be cognizant that if they're not really responding or improving, that we have other solutions that might be more helpful for these really difficult cases, for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So I wanted to ask you about that. My last bullet point that I forgot to say, because I think there's still a lot of good and bad information out there about running gait, but the big cues that I'll try with people that are dealing with an insertional Achilles issue is kind of counterintuitive, but increasing cadence sometimes can help. So just kind of cueing them to, you know, gradually, or not gradually, but slightly increase their cadence from their preferred step rate sometimes helps offload. And then, yeah, anything, just kind of cleaning anything up the chain that's like really glaring as far as the pelvis or the knees can be a factor as well. But that's a big one that I use, is increasing cadence. But yeah, kind of next steps, if we're kind of not getting anywhere with PT, kind of what are our other options for these folks?
Yeah, so this is these are the patients where we're starting to talk about injections or some other more invasive procedures. So typically, we definitely want to avoid cortisone near this area, because even under ultrasound guidance, as you're injecting, say you know, most of us will inject into the bursa if you're going to inject, if it appears swollen. But I mean, there's not really much separating that bursa from the tendon itself at the interface, because the tendon, on the Achilles tendon, unlike other types of tendons, doesn't really have a sheath. It has something called a peritenon, which is basically just this thin layer of connective tissue that surrounds the Achilles. So I equate this to like the casing around a sausage. So so there's really not much of a barrier between the bursa and the tendon itself. So I hesitate to inject cortisone even into that region, just because of that risk of rupturing the Achilles tendon. We had Dr. Ribniak recently talking about PRP, or platelet-rich plasma. And one of the things he mentioned was that we have a lot more of a difficult time treating insertional Achilles tendon pain with PRP than we do mid portion. And there's very minimal literature on this. I think I've come across one paper which described, I think it's like a 53% success rate. So for something that's quite invasive, it's really not much better than a coin flip. And I think the reason for that is because really what you're doing is you're just really addressing the surrounding soft tissue. But in the case of a Haglund's deformity, you're not really addressing the bony lesion. So eventually, with enough training and cumulative load, it's likely to then reemerge at some point with high levels of training. So is it an option? Yes. I suppose if there's no bony deformity and you're just talking about an isolated retrocalcaneal bursa or an isolated Achilles tendinopathy, like in that very like narrow selection of patient, this might be useful. But I personally have gotten away from these just because I wasn't really seeing great success. And if this literature, you know, other people trying to reproduce this as 53%, then, you know, that's not really an effective thing.
Yeah, that's tough. And I haven't seen, just like, you know, the folks that I've seen who have had PRP, not great results in terms of, I would say it's probably around 50% success rate, which, you know, maybe that's great. If, you know, if it was me, maybe that's something that I would think about trying. I understand that perspective. But then when you think about it from like, well, is this just kind of kicking the can down the line and you're putting yourself 6 months or a year out from really addressing the problem?
Yeah, totally. This is where you kind of talk to the athlete about their goals. And if they, you know, if they're just trying to get through a season, maybe that's a reasonable option. But if your goal is to kind of resolve the issue and kind of have a lifelong career running, then there are probably better options available.
Mm-hmm.
One of the cool, exciting things that's starting to emerge is something called 10X. This is otherwise known as percutaneous tenotomy. So this is somewhere midway between like an injection and a surgery. So it's a minimally invasive procedure where basically they create a small incision, and then the procedure is performed under ultrasound guidance, and they use this device called 10X, which is essentially like a micro tip. And it has like different gauges, and it has like a pen-like function. So picture like the hole of a pen, and then the pen kind of emerging through it as you click it and push it back. You get that longitudinal movement of the micro tip moving back and forth. And what this basically does is it shoots out. So you're under ultrasound, you come near the site of the injury, and basically the micro tip does all the work. So it essentially works as like almost like a jackhammer. And what's happening is it'll constantly push out saline to irrigate the area. And then it can then basically debride or aspirate the diseased tendon while sparing the healthy tendon. So that's another fairly exciting option that's out there. And there have been some prominent athletes who've had this. But one of the caveats of this is that there's still a lot we don't know in terms of like long-term results. What we know is that it's relatively safe. One of the potential risks is thermal injury, because it does create heat with this thing, because it's essentially as it debrides the tendon, it generates some degree of heat, and the saline helps cool it to a certain degree. But if you just kind of leave the tip there for too long, you can create like a thermal injury or a burn in the skin, which can be challenging to deal with.
So that's addressing the tendon, but not necessarily anything with the bursa or the Haglunds.
This is actually the cool thing is like the advantage is you can address all the things because models of 10X come with a bone tip. So you can actually debride like the bony deformity. So the limitations are now because you're doing this under ultrasound, you're looking at a 2D image of a 3D structure. So what we don't know long term is what the rate of recurring Haglund's deformity is, because the debate in these is like, well, how much bone do we remove? And there's actually not really clear guidelines. You know, you remove too little, and then you have the risk of persisting pain and functional limitation. If you remove too much, you risk weakening the gastroxoleus complex. So, there's not a lot of people who do this particular procedure, but there are a couple of really, really respected people. Like I know Madarik Hall at University of Iowa, he's presented on this, and he's one of the leaders who's trying to push out some research just so we can like learn more about it in terms of like the safety, the efficacy, and then the long-term outcomes. But yeah, so you can address you can decompress the bursa, you can debride the tendon, and then you can resect to some degree some of the bone.
Mm, okay. Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's always the least invasive option is always, you know, always great. But I know you've explained to me in the past as well. Part of the issue is, yeah, like you said, recurrence of the injury. If even some individuals have had a surgery arthroscopically and then it comes back because they didn't quite address maybe all of the Haglunds, and it's still irritated the tendon once that person maybe gets back to full training.
This is interesting because I've had a couple cases of where my perspective is as non-surgical, so I'm seeing these athletes on that side of things, so I don't know what the literature of the general population is, but when I saw my first recurring case about a year ago, I looked this up, and there's not really great literature defining what the recurrence rate is. So what we're talking about is basically there's two surgical techniques. So there's like an endoscopic, where you're essentially using a small camera, small incision, and then basically using a heating element to break down the bone and then debride the Achilles. Trying to leave as much of the Achilles as intact as possible. And the advantage is it's a smaller incision and theoretically less downtime, but you know there are still risks of injuring the nerves. And then the big one I've seen is an incomplete resection. So I've had about two or three athletes who had done great for maybe two or three years, but then eventually develop recurring symptoms. And in one of them, they actually avulsed a piece of the tendon off of the calcaneus. So that was interesting, and we're probably going to write that up because I haven't seen literature on that. So that's one, just something to consider when you're looking at the arthroscopic technique, is that they're probably getting relief because they're getting the area decompressed. But if that bony deformity isn't totally resected because you don't have full visual field, then you risk having this patient return a couple years down the line. Whereas the other technique is an open procedure. And so basically this is just a slightly bigger incision. So it's, they have the patient sidelying, they basically create a 3 to 5 centimeter incision along the lateral aspect of the ankle. So the outside portion of the ankle, just above the tuberosity of the calcaneus. So then that gives you a full field of view. It exposes the bursa, and you're able to clean that out or resect that without disturbing the Achilles tendon. And you're also in the surgery able to have an x-ray at the time, so you can calculate degree of excision. And what they actually use is like a cold microtome. So it's like a cold steel blunt blade, which then they use to resect that bony lesion. So that makes a difference too, because cold versus heat, you have less theoretical risk of creating scarring of the Achilles tendon. Because that's another thing I've seen with the arthroscopic patients who've had arthroscopic surgeries, and they tend to still have persisting issues with scarring, which creates issues. So you don't have that as frequently with the open procedure. Now the downside is it's about 8 to 12 weeks to return to run. So for some people, that's a tough thing to swallow. But you know, looking at like long-term outcomes, these patients tend to do quite well, and you've seen several big name athletes who've had this procedure and are doing quite well afterwards.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we should say it's 8 to 12 weeks for the more invasive procedure, but still it's going to be, you know, realistically 6 to 8 weeks for arthroscopic surgery as well. So it's a month sooner or so, maybe 6 weeks difference. So I think fairly marginal in the long-term scheme of things. And I've seen people do great from both perspectives, but yeah, some of the arthroscopic folks they're doing so well that a month out that it's almost like they're doing too good, because you have to hold them back because they're like, well, I can run, I can do anything I want now, you know? So, so which is great. But yeah, I've seen great results on both. The slightly larger incision is still a pretty tiny, you know, little 3 to 5 centimeter incision. But yeah, people do well. It just takes time, because then they've been non-weight bearing for a few weeks at least. And got to kind of build up some calf strength from an already like deficit spot before the surgery. So yeah, that just takes time.
Totally, because they're going to be casted and booted as well for a period of time. So they'll lose that strength. Mm-hmm. Important thing too is like, two things. One I should mention is like the techniques that we're talking about do not involve detaching the Achilles. That's always a fear that some athletes have of moving forward with the surgery is there are some older techniques where they used to, you know, detach the Achilles, shave the bone down, and then reattach the Achilles. I think most of us are tending to move past that now and saying, no, we want to leave the Achilles alone, because those patients, they tend to have better outcomes if you do as little the Achilles as possible. And then the other thing we're saying is like, yeah, this is just like initial return to run. I think we've had Bria, but bilateral Haglunds, and then also Jake on the show who had bilateral Haglunds, and they'll tell you it's like probably a solid year until they're like ready for like competition level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's even the quickest return to runs that I've seen is still one person I was working with asked her coach, because things are going well, maybe 6 months out, she was, you know, running I think 40 or 50 miles a week and getting into some light workouts, and she asked her coach, when do you think I'm going to be able to do a race again? And he was like, well, or no, she asked, when do you think I will be able to race? And he said, do you mean race well? Question mark. I think that was his way of saying like next season, you know, like it's still going to be like, you know, 6 months of solid training. So definitely not a quick fix, but I think it's exciting that like, you know, that there is an option. I know like 10 years ago when I was coming out of PT school, I basically had a PT bias and a runner bias from the running world of like, I would never let anyone cut my Achilles. I think, yeah, I've worked with so many people that have had a successful rehab after surgery, if it does come to that. So it's definitely something that like, if people have been dealing with this for over a year or multiple years, or sometimes it's like a 5 year thing of people trying to manage it. It's something to consider rather than just, you know, stopping running. So it's nice that we have an option now, you know?
Yeah. I'm guessing like, I mean, I wasn't practicing 10 years ago. I was still in residency, but I imagine these might've been conversations about like, you know, retirement from running.
Oh, totally. Yeah. It was, and guys on my college team, one of the best guys on my college team, that's the reason he stopped running. He had bilateral Haglunds, and, you know, I don't think he, at the time we didn't have great, management in, from what I know now, for things like that. But, he unfortunately like probably could have continued running post-collegiately and, you know, really probably had a better college career, But it's definitely a career ending injury for a lot of people. if there was one single largest career ending injury out there for running, I would put my money on insertional Achilles tendinopathy as the biggest single reason that people would stop running from like an injury perspective.
Yeah. So if you're out there and you have this, just know that there are some good solutions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And most people do get better with conservative management and PT and, you know, modifying your training and building back up gradually. And, you know, sometimes just recognizing that I can do 90% of what I want to do, and maybe that's good enough, you know, unless you're trying to be the best in the world. But even in that case, it's like, if you can do almost everything you want to do and you can and get away with that, then that's great. So very individual, but there's lots of options out there. Well, that was awesome. Thanks so much for the information.
Yeah, this is a cool topic. I mean, I think in our little hub in Boulder, we've seen several athletes with this and kind of deal with both ends of the spectrum of some being able to successfully manage these non-surgically and some kind of really dealing with the frustrations of this being a recurring theme, and then maybe coming out the other end after surgery and really getting their careers back. And it's just we definitely felt this was an important topic to get out there, even though it may not affect a large volume of people. It's still out there, and it's good. We really wanted to get this to the listeners so that they know that what to look for, kind of how to navigate these injuries, so you're not just you're not stuck, getting into the right hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a tough one, but there's definitely hope, and it definitely gets better. So
yeah. So we'll post a couple of the some of the studies and links to some of the types of procedures we talked about, just to get a little bit more education out there. And I think it'd be cool. I think I was talking to one of my old colleagues to learn a little bit more about the 10X procedure in more depth, because that seems to be an exciting thing. And a lot of these guys are using it for insertional Achilles pain, but also for plantar fasciitis, which is another, probably another episode we need to do at some point, because that's a very common and frustrating condition.
Totally. Yeah. It's another one of the most common ones. And it can be like super quick fix or very persistent. So that'd be a good one. But yeah, I've heard of 10X for that as well. Cool. Awesome.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Yeah. You as well.